Accession number 12713, Mr. Tony Temple, Reel 5.
Mr. Tony Temple, Reel 5. Your musical practicing and training would be going on, Mr. Temple.
Yes, we were probably the only section of the regiment or the battalion which could carry out. Very difficult for the rifle companies to do any sort of training other than physical training in the gangways or alleyways where they could find all of the mess decks. Rifle training and weapon training was purely simply out of the question. It was always given over to lectures, so far as they were concerned, and all sorts of keep fit games like deck quoits, wrestling, boxing, the usual things which you could do on board ship. But we had to still carry on our training. We were given concerts off to the, again, to officers. When we went, the officers were still travelling with us, and with officers from the Navy and from other regiments who were with us, they would have an officers' night. We would have to play at that officers' night. But we were limited to the scope of the programmes. By virtue of the fact, majority of our stuff was in the hold. We could go down if the colonel, which was then Major Heslop, requested something special and we hadn't had it on board, then we had permission to go down into the hold under supervision of the crew, one of the crew, to take out what we wanted and then put back, you know. This was always arranged. But basically, we were very restricted to the sort of stuff that we could carry on deck, as it were. We still carried our instruments, but we was restricted to the sort of programme that we were put on. But it never stopped. Either just normal practice or giving concerts to the men, to the officers' mess, to the married families, because married families used to travel on just the same. Although our married families didn't go to Shanghai, so we had none of our own married families with us. None of the wives came with us at all. The men who were married didn't meet up with the wives until we got to Tsim. Because in Shanghai, there was no provision for them. It was actually an international concession where all the nations that had concessions in China had got together to make the international concession, other than France. They again, the Frenchmen, they would have it their own little way and have it their little patches with the French concession. But the rest of them, like Italy, America, Great Britain, had the full whack of their own, and they just made it one big city, Shanghai. And the French were left out on their own. They said, well, you get on with it. You want to be on your own, you're on your own, mate. But we kept our own. And so consequently, there was no provision for married quarters, only for barracks. And they, as I say, they didn't join up with the men until we got to Tsim, where there was the special quarters provided for them next to the barracks. So life went on as practically as normal as it could be with the restrictions that we had on board ship. But we thoroughly enjoyed it.
It was a long journey, and obviously you would be bored at times. How did you overcome that?
Well, some of the things that the men used to organise themselves, for instance, they would organise the tombola. And this was a proper Swiss at times, because it wasn't organised by anybody except some of the men would get together and organise it. Well, the swindlers that used to go on was nobody's business. And then another crew over there would have a gambling school going. Somebody else over there would have the crown and anchor going. All the while, you know, when we were going over there, and we used to, maybe 150 of us are playing, maybe sixpence a ticket, and they were paying about 10 shillings or something like that. They must have made a fortune out of us. But nevertheless, it was entertaining. We used to look forward to it at night. I don't think the blokes minded that so much, because it helped to kill the boredom. And if you had money to spare, of course, you would try the Crown and Anchor, which the crew used to run. That was very hell of a money-making game, that Crown and Anchor. And the gambling school that used to go on, you know, for various things. If you were caught gambling, they told you for the high jump, but I think they closed a blind eye to it, especially on board ship.
Yes, I was going to ask you, was it a legal thing as far as the army concerned?
No, it wasn't, Tony. This was one of the things that the army used to frown on, because they felt it made more enemies than friends. And this had been proved right time and time again, that you lost, and the army used to frown on this. It went on. And I think at times, as I said, they used to close their eyes to it, especially on board ship, because there was so much boredom on. You're on a month's journey. And it went on, but they knew it was going on, but they closed their eyes. So long as it didn't get out of hand. They didn't allow it to get out of hand, and we used to play a game which was always watched whenever it took part of what we used to call shit and shangers. It's a funny game. We used to have the ruler. He was the master of this game. And it was all sorts of rituals that they used to go through. And he had blokes around him who knew that, knew all the... And he used to say, well, where's the Holy Dido? And the Holy Dido was an old belt, leather belt that he had. And where's the Holy Dido? And they used to go on, and they even chucked the adjutant into the swimming pool. We had one of these canvas swimming pools, you know, a very small one. And I see a stranger. So the holy man said, and who's a stranger? And they would go through this ritual of describing this stranger, of course, the adjutant, being, didn't know what the hell was going on. He shouldn't have been there in any case, but he was watching what was going on. They just grabbed him, and into the pool he went. They grabbed another bloke during the course of the journey and said, what's his offence? It was all read out in proper court-martial fashion. Oh, he's guilty. What's his sentence? He's got to go over the side. We don't want him aboard this ship. So they stripped him, put a blindfold off him, and hoisted him aloft as if he was going over the side. Well, the bloke was yelling blue murder. Of course, they dropped him, but he dropped in the swimming pool, and he was floating in the swimming pool trying to get up. And it held everybody's interest. You know, even some of the married people used to watch this performance, but very quick off the mark. As soon as they said go, like, you had to run fast in case you were the next one. They used to get up to all sorts of tricks. But this sort of thing used to do away with the boredom. We always used to look forward to this at the end of the day, like in the evening, when it cooled down a bit. And there was all sorts of things going on that kept the boredom at bay, as it were, for a while. Towards the end of the journey, of course, it became so instinctive that everybody would say, oh, I'm a bother, I've seen it so many times. You didn't bother. Towards the end of the last week, the beginning of the third week, things were really getting bored. I wouldn't say they were getting on each other's nerves. There was no such thing as fights broke out. Boxing was still kept on going. Yeah, deck tennis, the competitions at the offices were organised with the RSM. One of the things that we used to do in our regiment, keep the men busy and don't let them think of boredom. Keep them busy the whole time. We used to curse them on all sorts, only give us 5 minutes, you know. But the boredom was kept at bay in that sense. Oh, I would think, until the last week when the boredom really took hold on. And people were just long enough. No fights broke out, mind. You know, there was, the regimental peace was still walking around, making sure that everybody's doing the right thing. But we used to enjoy ourselves on board, really. Of course, it was always interspersed. I think it was about every 3 days that we used to come to some sort of port. You see, from Port Sudan, we went to Port Suez. We just briefly stopped there. The next port of call was Bombay, across the Indian Ocean to Bombay, where we spent a couple of days. And then we went to... we marched round the Bombay city to get ease our legs off a bit and came back again. The following day, we marched to what they called the Back Bay swim paths, where we went to march again, because it was all march, there was no transport provided. We went to these swim baths, had to swim, and some of us were swimming in the sea. Although it was shark infested, the shark nets were out, of course, you know, to stop the sharks from coming in. That was 2 days in Bombay, which we enjoyed. And you see, you know, once we'd set sail from Bombay, the next port of call was Colombo, which was then Colombo and Ceylon. Again, it was another couple of days there. So your journey was broken up into little pairs of Aden, for instance. We didn't get off. We got off at Aden, but we didn't pull alongside. And the stench of that place. You could smell it miles away. The old sailors said, oh, bloody hell, there's Aden coming up again. And you could smell it a mile away. The other places were quite normal. And I say the last port of call before we stopped was Hong Kong, of course. We got off there. This was rather a peculiar one for the band boys. We arrived in Hong Kong, and there must have been some sort of message being passed on earlier to our arrival that the bandmaster from, I think it was the Middlesex Regiment, came on board. And we hadn't heard a thing about this. And we said to Dougie Bowen, the band sergeant, what's he come on board for, like, you know, because we had our own band sergeant and bandmaster. He said, well, you might as well know. He said, you're staying stuffed off and you're staying with I'm sure it was the Middlesex Regiment, you're staying with them. Because of the situation in Shanghai. Shanghai is completely surrounded with Japanese. And the war in itself was still going on then, albeit not viciously, but they had this, what we found out later, was this battalion of lost Chinese still buttoning it out with the Japanese on the outskirts of Shanghai, and the commanding officer had worried himself about this, being a bloke who did care. Major was a fella that did care. And he must have radioed on ahead and said, well, will you take the boys until such time as we can get this problem sorted out? Well, we got our heads together and we got all the Dougie Bonham after us, and we agreed and said, well, I'm sorry, but we're not stopping. You better go and tell Major Heslop that we're stopping with the regiment. And that we wouldn't mutiny, but we were determined that we were going to stay with the regiment. And possibly this had a lot to do with the restrictions that were placed on us when we went to Shanghai and Tientsin, because even in Tientsin and Peking, we were still surrounded by the Japanese, and any just a matter of a would explode anything, you know. We were really in a touchy situation. So this chased him off anyway, the bandmaster from the Middlesex Regiment, and Major Heslop decided with the bandmaster, Ribbon and Dougie Bourne, they had a talk about it, and they talked about the restrictions that we were going to be under, but we still wanted to be with it. We didn't want to be part from the regiment. We were part and parcel of it, and we wanted to continue. So they said, all right, you can carry on. So we went on to Shanghai with the regiment. And it was when we landed on the Bund in Shanghai, the usual thing occurred. We would for the luggage, you know, that the heavy stuff was always left to the Chinese coolies. They would unload it, brought on by transport, civilian transport, the main, because we had very little army transport out there. We just marched away to the, as we thought, we were going to the barracks, but we weren't. We got onto the race course, and now it's always a custom that when you relieve a regiment, you meet sort of halfway, and you say hello and goodbye sort of thing, and you play the regimental march as you depart the other regiment. And I think there was a bit of a ball up somewhere, because when we departed from the race course in Shanghai, the Royal Ulster Rifles, who we were relieving, were going one way, we were going another, and we were both playing the same regimental march, which was ours, light back. I never found out afterwards that apparently this was their second regimental march as well. So it served the dual purpose, really, but it was peculiar to see two regiments playing the same regimental march when you're supposed to be playing theirs, as we thought, that we were playing our own. And we left the race course, and
this was the same day, was it?
Yes, the same day. So when we disembarked, we marched to the race course where we met the Ulsters. And then we marched onwards to where we were going to be, as we thought, the barracks. But because of the situation in Shanghai and in China generally, there was reinforcements of troops had been sent, and they were billeted all over the place. Well, the Ulsters had been in UUN Road schools, where we had to go into UUN schools, and the Welsh regiment were in the barracks. Well, it was decided by the hierarchy that this would have to change, and we would have to go into the barracks because we were staying there. You see, if anything had happened, which did when we were out there, which was the crisis in 1938, we were the regiment who were out there, and that was our position, so we changed places with the Welsh regiment. They came at the school, and we went into the barracks. We had the Seaforth Highlanders, which were billeted in the race course. We had roughly about a brigade strength, I would think. But no artillery or anything like that. Royal Engineers we had, Service Corps fellas, which were the transport men, ordnance, the people, they were there. But we had no moral support or anything like that. Plenty of naval support, man. You know, I suppose they'd say, well, they don't need it, any artillery. Look at the damn guns they've got behind the Navy, because they could have done anything. We were transferred to the barracks, the Great Western Road Barracks, where we settled in for our term of a year.
What was your first impressions of Shanghai and China?
We got no impression, really, because we had no contact until after we got into the barracks. Even at the UUN Road School, there was nothing there. Our own cooks were performing. So we had no real contact with them until we got to the barracks itself, where in the barracks we had Chinese cooks, Chinese servants, and cleaning barrack rooms and things like that. We even used to have people looking after us as well, because at that time, the only thing that they didn't do was, of course, clean our rifles. These were kept in racks in the barrack room, chained up so that they couldn't take them out, and chained to the floor. They couldn't get them out. But the rest of the stuff, they were clean equipment and buttons and things like that for us. And before we received a payment, we used to contribute so much a week, and that would be shared amongst the number of Chinese coolies who were doing the cleaning, clean the barrack rooms and so forth.
A great deal of the bull was being done by
by us.
You would have done in England, was being done by...
Done by them. With the exception of boots and the old-fashioned bayonet scabbard, which was leather that had to be highly polished. The bayonet was burnished. It was like chromium plated. You couldn't tell the difference between chrome and this burnished steel. And we used to have special burnishes made of steel, and you were just sitting on burnishing the top of that bayonet and the bayonet blade. Until it shone, you could see your faces, and the boot of the scabbard is here was leather, and you could see your face, not much the same as you could see your face in your boots. They never used to do that. We had to do our own on that. Well, they couldn't. They hadn't the experience of doing it. But that was our first contact with them, and it was strange. It was a strange situation, really. You went into this foreign country, and it's difficult to describe, Harry, how you first met them, because they were a nation of people who were basically a peace-loving nation, you know. We were there taking part of their country off them, at least the businessmen were. This basically was the reason why we're there, was to protect British interests of coal mines, shippings, warehouses, you name it. We used to protect them. To protect them to such an extent that when a ship was coming in, China was rife at the time, the Chinese coast, with pirates and in the junks. And we often used to send a section of blokes out in a naval gunboat to board the ship, to bring them in and take them out. And whilst the Navy used to go escort us with a gunboat, they still wanted somebody on board in case they were boarded. And this is what I say, the sort of protection that used to go to riots or anything like that. It used to turn out a Chinese riot. These mainly were instigated by the Japanese, of course, to cause as much distress as possibly could. But in the main, we found it strange to get to grips with the Chinese people, because we'd been told about them, but you didn't really grasp it, had you? Not until you'd served amongst them. You see, after you'd been there for some time, the MT drivers, for instance, we had a few trucks, a small section of 3 tonners, 300 weights, 1500 weights, which we used to collect various things, fetching and carrying in general. The instructions were the drivers, if you're going to hit a Chinaman in an accident, make a good job of him. He's cheaper to bury than he is cheaper to repair. And they were told, accelerate your vehicle and you make a good job of him, make sure he's dead. And this was, and it couldn't be avoided, honey. The peculiarity of it, it was brought home forcibly. It did happen, there's no question of doubt. But it was the Chinese fault rather than our traffic. I mean, let's face it, there was no such thing as speed limits. The taxis used to hurtle through these streets, crammed with traffic, rickshaws, lorries, broken down cars, army lorries and buses and all sorts of things fleeing. But the bloody pace of things was fun. I mean, you talk about London and Paris, they weren't in the hunt. It was like being in Hyde Park compared with Shanghai. The traffic was, just went hell for leather. Of course, the Chinese had this belief that if their spirits used to follow them about wherever they went, their evil spirits, and if they could cross a road and miss a vehicle by a fraction, they would turn around and they would bow down to you and smile over your face, because you had killed all the spirits that were following him, and he could safely go home to his house and enjoy his evening meal. Because that driver, it didn't happen to our blokes, it happened to their own taxi drivers and own bus drivers. They were much in the same situation as what our fellows were. And it did happen a number of times that, look, don't break, hit him, make a good job of him. Because invariably, the majority were coolies, you know, or some lesser of the Chinese people. This was one of the customs we found hard to cope with, at least our drivers found hard to cope with, until they got used to it. And another one that was struck me as very peculiar, but was strange, again, peculiar to Chinese, we were often engaged by Chinese mandarins to play at weddings, funerals, or just to play music, whatever receptions that we have for the hierarchy that they had in the particular place. And it was weddings, of course, were quite a normal thing, that all the gear was carried around in this procession and we were at the head of the procession playing our music and everybody else was singing in Chinese. It was a hell of a shock, really. It was terrible. But never mind. And then we used to play when we got to the house and we were having this feast. We would feed after they would feed, of course. We wouldn't join the guests in that respect. We just played on, played anything, really. Because they couldn't understand our damn music anyway. I mean, ours damn music. We used to say, well, theirs was damn music as well. But the funerals were the most peculiar. They would ask you to play at this particular funeral. Now, the importance of the Mandarin who had died, or whoever, was gauged by the number of bearers he had to carry his coffin and the number of professional mourners. His family didn't mourn. They used to hire professional mourners to do those sort of things. And there was firecrackers going off, explosions were going off, and you were carrying this bloke around. The whole band was in the middle. There was a band at the back of Chinese. And you were taking circuitries around the town so as he could lose the evil spirits. And then he was taken away and the coffin was dumped and then he would all disperse. And we used to come back and talk to one, but we piled up this lad at the Shanghai YMCA. We used to go there quite a lot. And he said, well, look, he said, you don't bury him in there. In actual fact, he's been sneaked away. We were creating all this noise at the house. And while the procession was moving away, they would sneak away somewhere else and bury him in some remote place because they didn't want the evil spirits with him. So we would attract the evil spirits with all the noise that we were making, the band was making, and he would go and meet his ancestors without any evil spirits following him. This is the sort of situation you were trying to accept. And it was really, it wasn't, I suppose, we were there months before we really got into the full swing of it. It's a peculiar situation to be in, to try to accept this. I mean, they were really way back, so far as equipment and beliefs were concerned. You would watch them putting up this skyscraper, and you would wonder how the hell it managed to become straight, because they used to use bamboo scaffolding. Well, you know, bamboo, when it's anywhere, and it twists and it shapes, and we say, how the hell can they possibly manage it? And yet, when they take it down, there was the building. Wonderful craftsmen. And with these ancient tools, it was unbelievable, the stuff that they used to do. Absolutely unbelievable. They used to have their tradesmen would often come into the barracks. They were allowed, they used to get a pass from the brigade headquarters, wherever it was, and they were allowed in barracks. It was always inspected, but security wasn't what it was today. You know, we had no need for heavy security because nothing happened. They used to come round, they used to sell chocolates, and this old tailor came round. Well, I say old tailor, he was fairly well dressed, tall fella, handsome looking Chinaman. He came to the band because the band were allowed to wear civilian clothes, but we weren't. The boys weren't. And he looked at Charlie Ferguson, you know, Charlie Smurthwaite. And he's just a tiny fella, played the bassoon. And he just looked him up and down. He said, yes, I'll fetch it back in the morning for you. Chose the material, you know, went through, had a look at the material, had a look at him up and down. Oh, well, fair enough. He came back the next year for a fitting, and that suit was a perfect fit. And the material that he wanted. All done by hand craftsmen. No machines. All done by hand. All by craftsmen. And there was practically nothing to do with that. He just took it away, tied it up and brought it back the next day. So in 2 days, you had a suit. Perfectly finished, perfectly done, perfect fit.
Ultimately, over a period of time, obviously, did you get on well with the Chinese people around you?
Yeah, but I still think that, like in those days, wherever we went, you used to treat them as the lesser people. This was the attitude, I suppose, of most British people. Even the people who are earning a living out there, the bankers and the merchants, used to look down on us, and mine looked down on Chinese. So. But we used to get on well with them. We didn't used to ill-treat them in any sense or form, because if this was found out, Major Heslop used to jump, and jump fairly heavily on them. But we had our ups and downs with them. We had some, not so much in Shanghai, because the situation was dealt with us here by the Royal, Albert Channing, the Welsh Regiment, the HLI, and by the American Marines and some of the American Army. We used to get on, funnily enough, with the American Marines. And yet, funnily enough, the other regiments didn't. There was always battles in the town between the two. And we used to get on well with them. In fact, to such an extent that their officers used to invite us down to our officers down, and we used to invite them up to our officers, where we played, and they hadn't heard of this because they didn't have a band. We used to do jobs for them, as a matter of fact. Eventually, we used to play under their officers' mess, much as the same we played with our officers' mess. We used to get paid for it from them, but we did it for nothing for our own officers. And this exchange went on to the extent that they used to come up, we'll teach you baseball. Well, we hadn't an idea what baseball was about. Well, we need a big field. They said, oh, your Barrack Square will do that. The RSM nearly choked. Barrack Square baseball? But they got it. They got the square, but they said, we'll not use the baseball. We'll use what they call softball. And it's a big ball, I suppose the circumference would be about 9 inches. Soft padded, but the rules were identical. Identical to baseball, but we used to use this softball. And we became quite expert at it. We even converted them to our rugby, not the American football. And there was all sorts of sports went on between the various regiments. You know, we used to get on, let's say, well with the Royal Marine, with the American Marines. The Army, not so much, because we had nothing to do with them. But somehow, I don't know how it came about, but we became very friendly with the American Marines out there. They were great guys. As I say, we used to visit there, we used to drink with them in the town. And which there used to be battles between the nations, the Italians and the French, and, you know, the Americans were always involved somewhere or other. But we always used to side with the American Marines, not the Army. Well, they always the American Marines. And down Blood Alley, oh, dear me. People haven't seen anything until they've seen a place like Shanghai and Blood Alley. I mean, it was going on there. I mean, you talk about the stuff that goes on in Newcastle and London. That's a children's kindergarten, the Blood Alley in Shanghai. I mean, you were walking down the street. There was nothing for the huge machine to come belting down the street and just whip into a corner. Machine guns going for hell for leather, police vehicles. There was a bank raid going on in the day. No questions asked at all. They were straight in with the machine guns. If there was any bystander in the way, that was tough, mate. And they always had Sikh guards on the entrances, and they always used to search anybody and everybody. They could just have the law on their side. They could stop anybody and search. But it was known as the toughest city in the world, and I can believe it. I can believe it. You had to be very wary of these gangsters, obviously well organised. And trouble with the Japanese, of course. We always had trouble with those. As I say...
What problems did they bring about?
Well, mainly where we were, none of that outpost, the photograph I showed you of the outpost that we had, what we were manning, when we managed quite a few of them. We had quite a number of them. I think each company had one or two, dependent on the number that we were doing. We had very little of that. But the HLI did have one on the Suzhou Bridge, which went from the Shanghai International Settlement across the river to Suzhou, across the creek there. And stuff was cheaper over there than it was in Shanghai. This was obvious, same as the French concession, it was cheaper there. And we used to go into there to buy stuff. But over there, the one incident I remember well was they had their two sentries on their side, and we had our two sentries on our side. And the Maori people and the white people had been told consistently, don't go over there. We cannot do anything if anything happens to you over there. But because things were so cheap, well, they still used to risk going over there. And this particular day, there was two of them coming back with their goods that they'd bought, the two women. And these two sentries on our side heard their screams. And they were shouting help, so they just did nothing more, just fixed the bayonets and went over. And of course, they saw the Japanese soldiers molesting them. Well, they just do no more, just bayoneted them, brought these two back. That caused a bit of an international situation there, locally. And things were a bit tight for a few weeks. But the Governor General, who was in charge of the, had told them, look, you keep your, tell your fellas to keep your hands to yourself. And they said, well, look, there's nobody else gets over there. So they stopped it with that. We were pleased with that. We just said, well, sent two sentries on there. They used to do nothing. They had to stop it eventually. And this was possibly the only... We used to have the occasional fight with them, fist fight, in the bars. They were trying to lord it over us. We wouldn't stand for that at all. So at the finish, they stopped their blokes from coming in. And this fallacy about the Japanese being jiu-jitsu blokes, it was a load of bunkum. It really was. Because we always laid them out. There was no question about it. So they stopped their blokes from coming into Shanghai at all. And there was one, it wasn't an international situation, it was just that they wanted to have a victory parade. So they hadn't had the victory yet, but they wanted this parade. I think it was just another ploy, a political ploy, to say that we were the overlord masters of this particular area of China. And the GOC said, well, fair enough, go ahead. You know, they must have got the heads together with the other head of departments of various nationalities. And they said, right, oh, what are we going to do about it? We can't let our blokes out. So everybody was confined to barracks except the patrol, which was going on in these small 1,500-weight trucks that was going on to make sure that there was no problem at all. It went off well. It went off well. But there was no trouble caused. Naturally, there was no trouble caused. We were confined to barracks.
Did you see any of the cruelty which the Japanese were meting out to the Chinese?
We saw evidence of it, but we didn't see the actual act of it. We saw evidence when we used to go, and as I say, these what we used to call frontier posts, security posts, you could see the evidence of the Chinese mutilations lying by the roadside. Obviously, they'd been painted and they'd been cut with these samurai swords. But we didn't actually see any action, at least I didn't. I don't know whether other men of the regiment had seen some of the things. But certainly we had evidence of it at all. And there was always a constant, another peculiar thing about the Chinese, was their children. They had this belief that they didn't like baby girls. Boy, child, that's okay, mate, you can carry on living. But girls, in the main, by those families who didn't care, they just used to leave them by the roadside. And the authorities in Shanghai were constantly sending truckloads of coffins out to these outlying districts to pick them up, because they would just leave them lying. And the stench used to be something terrible. And this is the reason why they used to send these trucks out into the outlying districts to pull them in and bury them. And some unknown grave, we didn't even know who they were, but they were all girls. No boys were ever done that. They were all girls. This is another, let's say, a peculiarity of Chinese people.